Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. If at any time during this call you require assistance, please press star zero for an operator. Note that this call is being recorded on December 2nd, 2020. And I would like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Martin Roberge.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this strategy call on our Outlook 2021 piece. Obviously, this is a bigger than usual report, so I won't have time to cover everything today. But again, like the report is in your inbox. Should you have any questions following the call, feel free to give me a shout. There will be a question period at the end of the call as well, so keep that in mind. And the call will be about 35 minutes. A little bit longer than usual, but bear with me. Like I just want to make sure I hit all the key points. And let's start. Page one. We've got the summary of my asset mix positioning. A little change from last month. We boosted our weights in commodities. Again, like this is. Especially for like retail clients, there are no good ETFs to buy. I prefer the DBC ETF as it offers a 50-50 mix between energy and non-energy commodities. So commodities a boost to our overweight from 1% overweight to 3%. So I want to get one out of consensus call right from the get-go. Like even though the consensus is for stocks to be bonds, I believe that the surprising outcome this year will be that commodities will beat both these asset classes. And actually, I'm calling it the year of the awakening, So I look forward to just to provide you more color on that as I go through the presentation. But otherwise, underweight bonds, underweight cash, overweight non-U.S. equities relative to U.S. equities. Within the non-U.S. basket, it's EM first, EFI second, Canada third. We'll go through the details. Later on, but I bumped my target on the S&P to 3,800. That's about 4 or 5% from here, with earnings at 175. I reduced my target on the TSX. My earnings estimate was like way too high when I ran the models in July. So a slight decline, but still like about 7-8% return. Bond yield, second out of consensus call, I believe it will trade around 1 plus or minus 25 beeps. We all know that the big decline in the bonds is this year is when we broke below 1.3. So obviously I would be proven wrong if we were to rally past that mark. But otherwise, like 1% plus or minus 25 beeps. Gold, on commodities, crude unchanged, 50-55. Gold unchanged, 1900, 2100. Copper, big boost here. It's very surprising what we're seeing in the copper industry. We're seeing visible inventories at almost all-time lows. And producers' capex are still contracting year over year. This is unprecedented. We understand that the spec positions are crowded on the long side, but we continue to believe that there's upside near the $4 handle there. On the currencies, we're setting new targets of 88 for the Dixie, Euro 125, 78 cents Canadian dollar. Overall, the 2020 is well understood by investors. We all know it's going to be a year of global growth acceleration, probably more back half loaded as eventually vaccination gets the growth trajectory higher in the second half. But there are some particularities about this recovery that is a bit different from the past. First, it's still China-driven. China is driving the bus, and it's continued in the first half of the year as probably U.S. growth stays below, not below trend, but subpar, as we have to deal with the lockdowns and maybe the lack of big stimulus. So China being like the driver, like, makes me believe that this is more like 2002 to wherever we go. Okay, so not the last cycle, but the one before. The second point is that the U.S. dollar. Remember 2010, 11, because of the Greek debt crisis and sovereign debt crisis in Europe, the dollar was well bid up. Like, the dollar was strong. Not this time around. Okay, so the tailwinds of the U.S. dollar weakening will play out this cycle compared to the other cycles. Third factor, which is different, is that this is a goods-related recovery. As you know, lockdowns are having a negative impact on service-related sectors. So the fact that we're seeing this recovery driven by goods is such that, you know, we need more commodities. We need more raw materials to replenish the inventories that have been depleted because of this craze for goods rather than services. So this will likely play out still in the first half of the year. So we're going through probably the mother of all restocking cycle, which will support commodities. So so you can see that it's somewhat different than what we've seen in the last cycle. So it may well be that we are going through a cycle that will look more like 2003 to 2008 as opposed to 2009 to 2020. Okay, now let's look at some of those macro charts. On page 2, a little risk, a little downshift coming in economic momentum to start in Q1. And this is obviously a pocket of risk for markets. If you look at our reflation indicator, it is just the six-month rate of change on bonds, which have been going up from like, don't forget, the May was the reference point. Like, the 6 month is May, so we've been moving up. Crude oil as well. Dollar offsetting, dollar moving down is offsetting a bit, but overall, we are going to face slightly negative reflation pulses from market-based variables starting in Q1. And obviously, this will be compounded by any lockdowns that we have or more any additional lockdowns that we announce going forward. So we've got this pocket of growth risk coming in Q1. And Q1 is also the end of the road when it comes to the stimulative impact of the loose monetary policies that we've had or we've enjoyed this year. On page 3, you can see that in terms of balance sheet expansion, we're probably peaking around where we are at around 50%. And the short-term policy rates, actually, we've seen some emerging market central banks raising rates lately. So you can see in the second panel, but that we are at peak in terms of, we are at the bottom of short-term rates. The scale is inverted on the right. So we will need some stimulus, a reflationary bridge that will take us to the self-sustaining phase of the economy in the second half of the year. In between, as I've mentioned, there is a cushion, and the cushion is the restocking cycle, as you see on page 4. It's broad, like, it's all around the world. It's U.S., Canada, Germany, and Japan. And you can see the wide gaps between retail sales and inventory levels. So this is providing a cushion, okay, that was not there when we had the first wave of COVID-19 last March and April. Okay, so this is a kind of a a plus, but this is not enough, because if you flip on the following page, true, CEO confidence has rebounded and announces eventually a rebound in capital spending or business capex, which is the missing ingredient that we need to get the economy on a self-sustaining growth path. But this is coming probably more in the second half of this year, if not Q4. So we will need some form of stimulus in between as a bridge that take us to that path, more sustainable path. And for now, we are assuming that there will be something delivered. Will it be after Biden takes office? Before or after? It's hard to say, but it will need to come. Otherwise, we could face growth around zero, if not slightly negative in Q1 and maybe Q2. But I doubt, and you know how it goes. Normally, the market could force it, and that's why there's a pocket of risk for the market if it turns out that it forces Republicans and Democrats to sit down and get a deal done. But just to keep in mind that, the bad news is that we're not going to get a consumer/corporate spending cycle in the first half of the year, but that could well be a reality in the back half of 2021. Now, also, in Canada, I like to say the Liberals make it rain already. You can see the $198 billion in government and budget deficit is for the first 6 months, roughly as it was announced earlier this week. They're going to hit $400 billion by March next year, which is the end of the fiscal year. So by spreading dollars and giving money to households, Canada is in a good shape from a labor fund point of view, because we have now recouped about 2/3 of the job lost during the pandemic. So, and that's been a surprise to me, quite frankly. It's been a real surprise to me. And that's probably why Canadian retailers have done way better than I would have thought. But this truckload of money is, in a sense, maybe required to deal with the following situation in Canada on page 7, is that the consumer and corporations are debt-strapped. If you look relative to the U.S. consumers and U.S. corporations, I present in the first two panels the household debt to disposable income. It has come down because we've seen more disposable income because of the checks. And in the U.S., you're 88 versus 169, huge gap there. Same thing on the debt service, which is just a reminder that maybe it's no longer true that, the low rates are preventing or bidding on the debt service ratio, but it does. We've seen some relief because of the government's check, but it's still a situation where Canada, from a household's point of view, and then for the corporation, it's 71% debt to sales. It's unprecedented. It takes now 71 cents of debt in Canada to generate a dollar of sales, 34 cents in the U.S. So everybody talks about the U.S. Corporate debt bubble in the U.S. And how about Canada? And it's widespread. It's not just one sector. And interest payments, 3.9 as a percentage of sales, almost a record. So when you, I'm not going to get into that now, but when you use EV to EBITDA ratios in Canada, it looks cheap on a P ratio, but on an EV to EBITDA, it's expensive, okay? It's just a tad less expensive than the U.S. stock market. And that's why, one of the reasons why I like EMs and EFI markets better, because they don't have this leverage on their balance sheet. Now, let's switch to page 8 and address the Dixie. There are several reasons why we should be going down. This chart, I used to point at the peaks. Now I'm pointing at the bottoms. I want to highlight the bottoms. The bottoms in 08, the bottom in 2011, the bottom in 2018. Look at the growth momentum index. Okay, the blue dotted line, it's inverted on the scale, a right scale. When it goes down, it means that the economy is accelerating. When it goes up, it means the economy is downshifting. And you can see, looking at least at 06, the bottom in 06, the bottom in 2010, it took almost a year or two for the global economy to come down and send the signal that, you know, maybe the U.S. dollar is bottoming as well. So even though we could downshift, eventually, in a year or two, we're going to see a downshift for several months before the U.S. dollar bottoms out and reappreciate again. So there's no hurry to try to bottom fish this currency, understanding that also on the following page, real rates, short and long-term real rates, have a long lead time over the U.S. dollar. So we crunch like several charts, and we've got all leading indicators on almost anything. And the one for the Dixie is very clear, and the second panel is the one that works the best with the highest correlation. The plunge we've seen in real rates this year will still have an impact next year, okay, on the U.S. dollar. So it's not a question of if it goes down, it's by how much. We have a target of 88, which is, frankly, the bottom of 2018, okay? But if you look at the blue dotted line, it could get much uglier than that, okay? So for now, we assume 88, but there's downside risk to this this forecast, okay? So I will not address the debt situation and the budget deficit because you guys are all aware of that. But just to let you know that the twin deficit in the U.S. is not expected to bottom before 2023. Okay. All right. Now, the bonds. The only reason why we're reluctant to go with a surge in the yields, even though it would make sense to see a surge given the recovery, is that the new Fed inflation strategy, average inflation strategy, means that the Fed will wait way longer than usual before pulling the trigger. Historically, they would pull the trigger around 2% on inflation expectations, and you would see the Fed discounter, like the Fed discounter is the 12-month Fed futures. You would see it moving way ahead of the Fed funds. And this time around, because they are aiming for 2.325, I believe that the bonds will go up significantly if the inflation expectations at least first surpass or go beyond 2%, okay? And my hunch is that it's probably now 2.3, but let's wait at least until we see 2. So if we stay around 2, I don't think that we'll see the yields moving much higher, and my hunch is that these guys are determined to cap the level of rates. So I watched the two-year bond yields also, Fed discounter, and there's no movement there, even though we've seen an increase this week, very little on the short end of the curve. So I'm assuming 1% plus or minus 25 beeps. Okay. And now on commodities. All right, let's start on the left. It's just a reminder that there's, again, here a long lead and lag relationship between excess liquidity, which can be defined as M2 divided by industrial production or minus, and that's the blue dotted line. And you can see the surge we're getting is mostly driven by the spike in the Fed's balance sheet. Okay, and we're now at 30, down from 40% year over year. And you can see that in 2010 we peaked around 30%, and the CRB spot went up like 40-50% year over year. If I was to assume that we go at least 40-50, because we have more excess liquidity this time around versus 2010, and the dollar is going to be probably weaker this time around because there's no sovereign debt crisis and no Greek crisis, propping up the U.S. dollar. Well, 50% year-over-year change on the spot index, CRB, that's about 15, 20% from here if we just move sideways. So 20, like 10, 15 is better than what I'm forecasting for the stocks. Okay. And on fundamentals on the right, you can see commodities, all system go. Well, those are early cycle macro indicators that we monitor. And you can see that the first two panels, the red line, is where I expect to be somewhere in 2021. Global trade should be expanding. Emerging market LEIs should be above 100. And then the commodity currencies are already extremely strong. And this is no longer just China, okay? It's more LATAM currencies are participating finally as well a bit. So as you know, most emerging countries are net commodity importers. So that's obviously positive. So I want to remind and reiterate this first statement, that one key highlight of my report, of my outlook, is that commodities will do better than stocks and bonds. Okay. Now, global equities, page 12. We talked about the weaker dollar. Now, look at the technical picture. We broke down the uptrend that began in 2012. When we saw a similar breakdown in 2002, okay, we started a multi-year advance in non-U.S. equities or international equities relative to the U.S. Okay. Actually, from 2003 to 2008 at the peak, we did a triple, I believe, on commodity indexes, okay? So just to give you an idea of how powerful it was also for commodities. But here my point is that I'm not sure about a five-year cycle, okay? Because I'm not yet in the camp where value will strongly outperform growth, okay? We'll talk about that later on. But for 2021, if you look at the performance between U.S. and non-U.S. stocks this year, it's been, again, like a year where U.S. stocks have outperformed because of the FANGs and the growth stocks. But if you look at emerging markets, they've been tracking the U.S. stock market quite nicely, Japan as well. So the degree of underperformance is less. And one of the reasons is also probably related to buybacks. We wrote about buybacks several times in the past, and it's been one of the factors why U.S. stocks have been doing better than non-U.S. stocks. But if buybacks remain very muted because corporate profitability is not high enough to support to boost the free cash flow yields and free cash flows of companies so they can reinvest and buying back their stocks, well, it gives a hedge to non-U.S. companies where, as you know, buybacks are not in the culture of these companies. So we've got this tailwind, like it's a by default tailwind. And then you've got the U.S. dollar tailwind also that we have to keep in mind. So, and just going back to this pecking order, EMs, EFI, Canada, let's focus on those three. Very few of you looks historically at what are the drivers of outperformance when you look at Canada versus EMs, Canada versus EFI. We always look at Canada versus the U.S., but we forget about Canada versus global equities. So we've looked at several drivers of performance, and there's only one that matters, and it's the U.S. dollar again. So historically, when the U.S. dollar goes down, EMs and EFI regions outperform Canada. When the U.S. dollar goes up, it's the opposite, okay? So that's why I've got Canada at the bottom of my non-U.S. group. Now, in terms of U.S. equities, page 13, the outlook for profits, really good. As you can see, my indicator has surged. It's signaling an average growth of 16.8%. Like historically, when we are in the band, in that band between 0.25 and 0.5, or 0.41 on page 13, okay? It signals like a pretty strong recovery. We know what will be the December number. I can tell you it's going to be above 0.5 because this is a smoothed dotted line. So it means about 20% growth. We're adding 5% of a boost because of COVID-19 related savings. And that's how we get to 175. For Canada, forget about the consensus around 140 or 155. It's going to come down really hard. This is about 50% from where we are. Contrary to where we are in the U.S., where forward earnings are rising, going like in the fourth quarter, in Canada was still falling, if not stabilizing. So the growth rate upon which I should apply my 25% boost in Canada is lower than the base in the U.S. So I have to cut my earnings estimates, but still I'm using 26% in Canada because the last four recessions, when you start from the bottom, the average is 21%. When you add 5% because of COVID-19 related savings, you get to that 26. It gives you 850. And if you flip the page to page 14, you get the fair value, 38 for the S&P and 18 for 504 for the Canadian stock market. So that gives you mid-single-digit returns. And in order to do more than that, you're going to have to go into smaller caps. And that's page 15, okay? You can see that the small cap drivers, macro drivers, are all flashing green for Canada. You know, I've looked at the small cap in the U.S. relative to large cap. The same macro drivers are flashing green. Global growth recovery, rising inflation expectations, goods like manufacturing outperforming services, and the earnings revisions at the bottom is the one that I like the most because it tells you that we are still far from the peak in the small cap cycle. You know, the first leg of a small cap cycle is pure market timing. Okay, look at 2015. 2009, like you got to be right on timing the bottom of the market. So no way we're all able to do that. But it's important to catch the second and the third phase of the rally because those are very powerful. And this is where we are. Like we probably began the second phase in Q4. And historically, it's kind of counterintuitive, but when the earnings revisions in Canada hit zero, meaning that analysts are too optimistic on their revisions, this is when you got to get out, okay? And we're not there, as you can see. We're not there on the revisions, and we're not there on valuations. Look at the right. P/E ratio, we're around the historical average. EV/EBITDA, like around 7.5 times. In Canada, I repeat, and I want to stress it, Canadian large cap stocks are trading at 12 times EV/EBITDA, forward EV/EBITDA, not trailing. This is insane, okay? In Canada, small caps, median stock is at 7.5 times, okay? So I'm giving you like a couple of things. Can you make more than 10%? Non-US over US, commodities, small caps. You've got three ways to do more than 10%. Okay. Now, there are risk factors. These risk factors are tactical in nature. There will be rolling corrections, rallies, but no bear market. Our bear market timing indicator, as you may recall, turned green in September, so no bear markets on the horizon. That being said, the market will go up and down with sentiment and positioning. I'm getting a little bit nervous here because sentiment is back into the bullish zone, not the extremely bullish zone, but certainly the bullish zone with the equity allocation back to the 66% average and the spread between bull and bear like approaching 20. And as you can see, over the last 10% plus corrections, 2015, 18, 2020, we were way above, slightly above where we are today. So sentiment on a scale of 1 to 5, five being alert, alert, alert. We're at four. Positioning-wise, same conclusion. We're not yet above the $100 billion in notional that will normally mark a spec positions way too crowded on the bullish side. We're at 97.9. But one thing is for sure. If I'm right and we get to my target, 3,800 in the first quarter, well, probably I'm going to get this red flag in the first quarter of the year, and I will act accordingly, okay? So 97.9, and we get the updates every Monday. Stay tuned. Send an email. I'll forward it to you, but I will certainly write about it if we ever go much above 100. But, again, positioning is also bullish, but not yet extremely bullish. In Canada, this one is probably new for you. It's the second time we show it, but here it is. We look at the short interest on TSX listed stocks, and as you can see, we're around 1.2 million shares on the short side, and normally you got to go down to 900 million. And it's the number of shares, okay? In terms of market cap, you've got to go down to about 1.5% of the market cap. Once you get there, it means that the marginal buyers in the form of short covering activity is over. But you can see that there could be more short covering buying that could boost the market a little higher. So that's why I like to say that, yes, bullish, but not extremely bullish from a Canadian perspective. Okay, so that gives room for the TSX, obviously, to retest the high of the pre-COVID high around 17.9 something. Then in terms of sector rotation, where are we in the business cycle? A lot of people have been requesting this this work, so you're going to get something in December. So we're in phase one. Phase one is weak growth stabilization. As you can see, industrial production is still contracting year over year. We're getting better. OECD is not yet above 100, which is the boom bust line. So we're in phase one. But again, 2021 will probably take us into phase number two, which is going to be acceleration. And then look at the sector performance historically. Still phase one. The market has done this year exactly what it should have done. Technology, healthcare, discretionary. I hate myself for not playing the discretionary sector. It's been a bad call. I should have paid more attention to that, okay? But otherwise, it's an environment where you got to be in growth in phase number one. But in phase number two, you got to be moving more towards the late cyclicals, mid to late cyclicals, financials, industrials, basic materials. But you got to have some technology there as well. So that's why I have this title, Growth Equals Value, but Value Cyclicals doing better than Value Defensives. Value Defensives being REITs, utilities, telcos, all those bond proxies. Those guys, it's for phase number three, okay? So I urge you to neutralize your growth exposure, okay? Don't take too much benchmark deviations. This is not 2000. When the Fed was tightening, the yield curve was inverting, and global growth was above 5%, and 5% without an output gap. Now I hear folks saying, hey, Martin, we're going to get 5% this year, but with a wide output gap, a negative output gap. It's not the same 5%, okay? So you got to have some growth, and that's why I like the emerging markets for that reason, because it provides me with a bit of both, like a bit of value and a bit of U.S. It's all growth. Emerging markets give you a bit of a growth and a bit of value as well. Okay, now in terms of contrarian calls, we have three calls a year, integrated it's mostly like the Exxon, Chevron, and Oxy. But we want to capture the dividend yields there. Finally, Exxon is capitulating and cutting capex to provide visibility to their dividends. Same for Chevron. But the game here is to make sure to capture the dividend yields and also realize that when demand for gasoline will come back, there's been so many. As you know, auto sales have been booming, so those cars will not stay in driveways this summer, and there are risks that commuting will not be what it used to be anymore. So that demand for gasoline will come back, and when it does come back, I think the cracks will explode. Like crude inventories relative to gasoline inventories so high that refiners can get that oil very cheap and process it, and then sell it at huge margin. So obviously, we're not in an environment where gasoline demand is strong, but surprisingly, it has not come back down, even though we've seen some lockdowns in the U.S. Okay, so it's a year of good refining margins, where I believe we can capture the dividends, where I believe the dividends are safe, and also, as I had before, in terms of forecast, I see oil between 50 and 55, okay? Gold, I keep coming back to 2010, and I keep telling to everybody still buying gold as a hedge to sell all your gold. Sell them all. If you buy gold as a play on deflation or as a put option on markets or as a hedge on bad news, sell them all. This is late cycle thinking, like I would say 2016 when we had an industrial recession. Okay, that was the leg of the put option or the late cycle leg for gold. Now it's the early thinking. You got to switch your head to the early cycle thinking, which is the inflation / reflation play. And that's why I keep pointing to 2018. You want to see good news. You want to see 10 vaccine announcements, 20. You want to see strong PMI. You want to see strong economic data because it's going to crank up your inflation expectations. The first leg of a gold rally in a cycle is all driven by inflation expectations. Not a hedge about like politics or something. It's all about inflation expectations. And this is what we have in 2010, 1 year after the recovery. We got this correction in gold because the stock did very well. But inflation expectations stayed steady. And then gold came back. Once you plunge below the 200-day moving average, the weak hands sold, so you could go back. This is exactly where we are today. Okay, same dynamic. Bullish gap opening up between inflation expectations, which I believe are hitting 1.9%, and then the GDX below the 200-day moving average. And number three, fertilizers. This is an overlooked sector within the material group. You got basically everything you need to have for a sustainable recovery. China is importing again corn, wheat, soybeans, and you can see the ag index also doing extremely well. Food inflation and ag inflation is coming back. Fertilizer prices firming means higher farmers' income. Higher farmers' income means more fertilizer application. So this is a call that's been moving in the right direction lately, but I believe we're halfway into the recovery for CF, Nutrien, Mosaic, and all these fertilizer companies. So I stop here, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star followed by 1 on your touchtone phone. You will then hear a 3-tone prompt acknowledging your request. And should you wish to withdraw your question, simply press star followed by 2. And if you're using a speakerphone, we do ask that you please lift the handset before pressing any keys. Please go ahead and press star 1 now if you have a question. And your first question will be from Nino Marcotti at Echelon. Please go ahead.
Hi, Martin. Very quickly on gold then, and the talk around gold and Bitcoin.
Oh, your opinion is as good as mine. I know that, you know what? I think you have to have both. The issue maybe with the Bitcoin is that need to have both to the extent that you want to buy it as a play on the potential currency debasement. Okay, the reason why the Bitcoin is being bought is certainly because of that possibility. But the problem is that the liquidity, like, there's no liquidity there. So for an institutional investor, like, it's really hard to get there. And for liquidity reasons, I believe that you should own both. Okay.
And one follow-up, if I can, it really has to do with risk around China. You know, the push-pull right now, of course, China's firing on all cylinders. We look at the PMIs, et cetera, but to what extent, and some of the noise out of China has been somewhat disruptive, even disturbing around regulation, even around corporate bond defaults that day. Is that a headwind for markets? And of course, you know, a Chinese policy or policymakers tightening far too much and disrupting the sort of almost Goldilocks.
Well, you know, yeah, you know, the thing that we have to keep in mind is that it is China is now loosening. It's not re-tightening, but it's no longer pressing as hard on the gas pedal as before, which is normal because economic data has been extremely strong. But you've got this 100-year anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party in October. I really doubt that they want to screw up their economy going into those celebrations. So it's maybe a weak argument. But before we talk about having an impact of the corporate bond market or corporate bond default having an impact on the economy, I think we've got to talk about this possibility later down the road, not for 2021, especially not considering the fact that, not now considering that they are the bus driver. They know that they play a role in getting this global economy going, whether or not their reputation is tarnished because of the COVID-19 virus. I think they will play their role of making sure that they provide the backstops needed to make sure that the global economy is chugging along. And to the extent that there are risks with U.S.-China tariffs, this game is kind of over for me. Like, China is now building new relationships with their neighbors. We had a note on that. In November, they're creating the Eurasia zone. Now they're tightening Asia together. Eventually, they will do it with Europe, so it will be Eurasia. And that's about 80% of global trade. So I don't care too much about, for now, what the U.S. may do to China. Like, I just understand that they're creating their own import markets.
Block, yeah.
Blocks.
And what vehicle, finally, are you using for the Canada small cap?
Well, I don't think that XCS, I think, is the only ETF out there that you can buy. It's not overly liquid. It's liquid. Some days it is, some days it is not. But XCS is the portion of the TSX, which is in the small cap category. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you. Next question will be from Zion Lakhani at HSBC. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Martin, what kind of odds do you apply to us, you know, just having a short-term inflation trade, but then really the overwhelming demographics, debt, you know, deflation from technology and all that stuff just taking over again, and we just kind of go back to that shitty period we had most of the last decade?
I don't know what will be the deflation triggers. This is like the near term. If you look at the near term dynamics, monetary and fiscal policies are extremely supportive. We're going to hear more from Europe the ECB on December the 10th, and you know that they're going to deliver the mother of all bazooka, trying to put some ceiling on the euro. They are now creating this European debt market where Germany will be on hook if Italy goes bad. So they're doing all, like, it seems like we're getting to that point where we're kind of shielding the global economy, shielding the global economy, or kind of moving away from that deflation risk again. You obviously, the weaker dollar is a bottle of oxygen. So I really doubt that we are at this point where we got to fear like outright deflation. And don't forget, China, India, emerging markets now account for about two-thirds of global growth. And these central banks can still stimulate growth. Like we talk about the super debt cycle elsewhere, but this is the end for the DM debt cycle. The EM debt cycle is not as extended as the DM one. Like just for example, in China, we talk about corporate debt all the time. How about consumer debt at only 50% of the GDP? Well, maybe 55, 60 now. How about government debt, which is still around 60%? Like this is no, like not 100. And so there's still fiscal munitions, still monetary munitions in emerging markets to get this global economy going for a few years. I would be more concerned if we were tapped out both among DM and EM countries, but we're no longer there. That's number one. And number two, again, two-thirds, if not one, like three-fourths of global growth contribution would be coming from emerging markets going forward.
Did you have any further questions?
No, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question will be for Alexey Vorchek at Siona Investment.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for the presentation. I missed the very beginning of it, so maybe this question was already addressed, but maybe I can take the opposite view and ask you to talk about stagflation potentially. And it just seems as though every nation out there is signing up to the same program with stimulus monetary policy. As well, and all these themes that are popping up with electrification, green initiatives, and agree with you on the commodity space here that the bottleneck is there. So wondering if you can put that in context with stagflation.
Well, that stagflation will be when we get the inflation response from the higher commodity prices. And as you know, there's always a lag. The lag is questionable. Like, is it like a year, 2 years? I have no idea. But one thing is for sure, you're going to be right on the stagflation scenario if we go through a typical inflation cycle and a push through not only from the goods, but it will need to come from the services and from the wage. The one way to gauge the goods side of the equation is to look at the output gap. And as you know, the output gap is way too low for now. And from the services, you can look at the wages because, as you know, services account for a big chunk of GDP, and still the labor markets are still too loose. But the thing that I would say, though, is that this was not a typical recession. We provoked it or we closed it. As opposed to having a natural slowdown and then media balance sheet situation, or a balance sheet catalyst, over cyclical spending. This is not the typical recession. So the good thing is that we may come back or rebound faster than the typical rebounds we had in the past. So we could close like this output gap way earlier than normal, and we can firm the labor market maybe faster than the 3 to 4 years it at least takes to get some form of wage inflation. But the stagflation, I believe, will be the theme for the second half of the decade. I think 2024, 25 till 2030. I think that's the possibility. of stagflation. I would say that in the next 2, 3, 4 years, output gaps around the world, not U.S. only, but around the world, probably to wide still, and labor markets, as you know, the pool of labor is going to get bigger because labor is no longer a domestic consideration but a global consideration. So the pool of labor is now bigger than it was to be because of the work from home. So before we get wage inflation in the system, it's going to probably take a little while. So yeah, I agree, maybe just not on the timing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star followed by one on your touchtone phone. And at this time, Monsieur Roberge, we have no other questions registered.
All right. So thanks a lot for attending the call. If I don't talk to you before the end of the year, have a Merry Christmas. It seems like, at least here in Quebec, they're going to enforce the no visits or the family dinners only. Like they were thinking about opening 4 days or allowing 4 days of traveling to families, but we got such bad COVID numbers lately. We've had such bad numbers that it's going to be probably a very small a Christmas party here in Quebec, at least for us. The next report will be February. So in between, obviously, I will keep on watching the market and crunching charts, and feel free to give me a shout, send an email should you need anything from me or from Guillaume. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this does indeed conclude your conference call for today. Once again, thank you for attending. And at this time, we do ask that you please disconnect your lines.